Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
Listening to Back in the USSR on CFRU 93.3 FM, I am Siegfried, and I want to thank you all for tuning in. Given the time of year and everything that's been going on, I mean, you might be expecting me to do another anti-war Remembrance Day show or talk about the results of the US election. But tonight I want to focus on something that happened 2 days and 103 years ago on November 7th, 1917. I'm speaking, of course, about the Bolshevik Revolution, perhaps the most earth-shaking and epoch-changing event of the last century, an event which really set the stage for further revolutions, labor struggles, and anti-colonial revolts all around the world. You know, through its radical example, the revolution that brought down the Tsarist Russian Empire and forged a new socialist state also sounded the death knell for every single one of the centuries-old colonial empires that still dominated the globe in 1917. In the words of John Reed, an American journalist and author of 10 Days That Shook the World, his words provide a glimpse into the cataclysmic events that took place in November 1917, and that would follow the birth of the young USSR. So, quote, "I suddenly realized that the devout Russian people no longer needed priests to pray them into heaven. On earth, they were building a kingdom brighter than any heaven had to offer, and for which it was a glory to die." End quote. The diverse peoples of the Russian Empire in 1917 rejected the old order. They rejected war. They rejected empire. And they rejected capitalism. The simple Bolshevik slogan of peace, land, and bread was what carried the day in a devastated country that had lost millions of people to World War I, an imperialist war of aggression. They had had enough. They had already overthrown the Tsar in February 1917, and now they were going to overthrow the entire system that had so victimized and exploited them. This is why they embraced the Bolshevik Party, led by Vladimir Lenin, and which would ultimately become the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. Now, to many in the West, the October Revolution is described in a few bland buzzwords in our history books, you know, words like Stalinist, dictatorial, authoritarian. None of which are entirely inaccurate, by the way. I mean, the October Revolution was dictatorial. It was dictatorial to the people who exploited the masses. And it suppressed them by organizing the small farmers, the peasants, and industrial workers together, as well as those who had been colonized, those oppressed peoples who had been colonized by the Russian Empire, mobilized them as well. Everybody from like the Jewish population of Russia to the Uzbeks to the Yakuts, the Georgians, Armenians, mobilized them all to build a new socialist order. And the October Revolution was authoritarian to the rich merchants, the nobility, the financiers, the factory owners, and agribusiness profiteers. It divided their wealth and used it to rebuild, not rebuild, but build a new society. One where the wealth that was produced would benefit the people. You know, not this tiny few at the top. Within the space of a few decades, in a transformation that is just basically has no equal, with the possible exception of the transformation of China and what they've experienced in the last few decades, within the space of a few decades, the USSR went from an impoverished, semi-feudal society, you know, to a highly advanced and modern industrial society, surpassing its Western counterparts in many areas, including space exploration. You know, in the fields of science, education, health, literature, sport, and more. I mean, the USSR exploded just in every direction, routinely making much wealthier Western countries look worse off, just because the USSR was achieving so much in such a short time. And the pioneering achievements of the Soviet Union began almost immediately. I mean, right after the revolution of 1917, Lenin, as the leader of the world's first socialist state, he wasn't just confronted with a civil war, a Russian civil war fomented by 17 foreign armies that had intervened to try to restore the old order that had been overthrown, but also with a disease pandemic of catastrophic proportions, which often gets cited, or has been cited over the course of this year, the Spanish flu, right? Often the COVID pandemic is compared to the Spanish flu. But the Spanish flu, we have to admit, was one hell of a lot worse. I mean, it spread throughout the former territory of the Russian Empire during the Russian Civil War, infecting nearly half the population. Nearly half the population. And the pandemic led to the deaths of up to 2.7 million people in just 18 months in Russia alone. And even claimed the life of one of Lenin's closest allies, Yakov Sverdlov, of the All-Russian Central Executive Committee. So it was even affecting like high-profile Bolsheviks. You know, they were dying of the Spanish flu. And of course, it was killing millions of people all over the world. And, but it was in the wake of the Spanish flu, of this devastating pandemic, that Lenin became one of the driving forces behind the adoption of universal public health care in the Soviet Union. And really, and with it, he was basically also the pioneer of universal public health care worldwide. I mean, no country had a notable public health care system before then. Most doctors either worked for themselves or were funded by charities or churches, and most people had no access to them at all. I mean, you might recall me talking in the past about how my granddad, who was born in 1918 and grew up in a coal mining town in northern England, without electricity, running water, sanitation, or healthcare. And remember, this is, and that was in one of the wealthiest countries on the planet, then as now. You know, and people in towns like that had to wait until after World War II and the creation of the NHS to get healthcare access. Whereas people in the USSR, a much poorer country, got public healthcare access in the 20s and 30s due to the pioneering efforts of socialism. So that was a real milestone. I mean, in 1920, the Soviet Union became the first country to put in place a centralized public healthcare system, funded via a state-run insurance plan, which Western countries were ultimately forced to emulate, largely due to rising working-class unrest and the fear of revolution. And it's worth pointing out that one of the main reasons why Western elites have been so brazen about cutting healthcare services over the past 30 years is because after the fall of the USSR, they were no longer afraid of a socialist revolution breaking out in their own countries. And the same is true for women's rights, labor rights, civil rights, and others. Fear of socialism forced capitalist governments to make concessions in the 20th century. But now that fear is gone, and the concessions are being rolled back. And in many cases, the challenge of organizing, of progressive organizing today is to basically make, restore that fear, you could say, in the elites that they could be overthrown. You could say like that's one of the goals, you might say. The combination of the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917 and the Treaty of Versailles in 1919, the combination of these two major events had the effect of radicalizing millions of colonized and oppressed peoples worldwide. You know, it wasn't just working class people who were inspired by what happened in 1917 in Russia. It was also colonized peoples all over the world. People were just lived under the boot of colonialism, you know, just the boot of colonialism all over the world, who were being exploited and downtrodden and like oppressed by all these racist laws and imperial military forces coming in and dominating them. You know, I mean, from Vietnam to the American South, you know, you had like people who were radicalized by these two events. I mean, W.E.B. Du Bois, the U.S. civil rights icon and unapologetic communist, and Ho Chi Minh, who would ultimately lead the socialist revolution in Vietnam, were as inspired by the new Soviet Union, by the new USSR, as they were angered by the betrayal of colonized peoples by the victorious Allies in World War I. You know, I mean, there was a real hope at that time that maybe after the victory in World War I, the Allied powers might give at least some limited self-governance to the colonies. You know, there would at least be some autonomy, you know, some self-determination that might emerge in the end of the war. And all those hopes were dashed. I mean, there were no concessions there at the Treaty of Versailles. Basically, all the hopes of the colonized peoples were just destroyed. You know, the colonizers weren't going to let go. You know, they weren't going to loosen their grip on the global South. So that radicalized a lot of people. That radicalized tons of people. I mean, you also had the May 4th movement of Chinese students who were angered by the Versailles Treaty and how it sold them out, sold out the Chinese people to continued imperialism and colonial domination by the Europeans and by Japan. And many of those students, many of those people who were mobilized against the Treaty of Versailles would ultimately take inspiration from the Bolshevik Revolution too. giving rise to the Chinese Communist Movement, which would emerge victorious in 1949. And that's not even mentioning the Cuban Revolution, the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa, the resistance to the Vietnam War, the downfall of European colonization in Africa, the rise of the so-called pink tide of left-wing movements in Latin America, you know, at the end of the 20th century, and the dozens and dozens of other historical events that probably would never have happened without the Bolshevik Revolution and the political forces set into motion by it, you know, whereby working class and oppressed people were taking power or threatening to take power all over the world. You know, and that basically put the ruling class on the back foot. You know, even the defeat of Nazi Germany in May 1945, a date which, in my opinion, is what we should be celebrating every year rather than November 11th, that would almost certainly have never happened without the USSR's gigantic contribution to turning the tide in World War II. I mean, there can be absolutely no doubt that the October Revolution was one of the greatest events of the 20th century, demonstrating beyond a shadow of a doubt that even in the most difficult circumstances and harshest of times and conditions, working class and oppressed people can and will prevail. They can win through, they can win victories. And this is very important to understand given the circumstances that we face today. This brings me to the U.S. election, brothers and sisters, which I really don't want to talk too much about, but I really can't avoid mentioning either. Donald Trump is finished. Joe Biden has won. Not by a huge margin, but he's won. The paranoid idea that Trump was going to launch a coup or start a civil war proved to be unfounded. And I think it proves the point that he was not an exceptional threat or a Hitler wannabe, just a capitalist swindler with an ego and a marketing strategy. You know, particularly like, you know, despicable marketing strategy, but a marketing strategy nonetheless. And the idea that a guy like him is exceptional or unprecedented in American history is just laughable. Yeah, I mean, if you look at the kind of racist right-wing populism that was employed by presidents from Woodrow Wilson to Ronald Reagan, all of whom sought to buttress capitalism by reinforcing the racial divide within American society. I mean, Woodrow Wilson even endorsed the KKK, you know, pretty openly. And I fail to see how a half-senile old white dude and a middle-aged black woman who built her career on serving the same racist prison industrial complex that her running mate played such a key role in setting up in the 80s and 90s, I fail to see how they will improve things. Especially given that Biden's explicitly campaigned against basically every single policy item proposed by Bernie Sanders and the DSA. You know, that being said, I mean, Trump did provide a lot of encouragement to far-right forces around the world. A lot of destructive encouragement. And if this loss can take at least some of the wind out of their sails, that would be a good thing. I mean, if Jair Bolsonaro, the president of Brazil, chooses not to run for re-election in Brazil because Trump lost, and that's something he's been talking about. I mean, like he seems really deflated these days since Trump lost. If he decides not to run for re-election, that would be amazing. I mean, just look at the damage he's done to Brazil, like during the pandemic. And how destructive his policies have been. I mean, getting him out of there would be absolutely great. Still, I don't think Biden is going to withdraw support for the same Ukrainian neo-Nazis that he did so much to put in power in 2014. You know, that's just too much to hope for. It's been part of American foreign policy since the start of the Cold War to encourage right-wing forces and right-wing violence around the world as a means of stopping leftist and progressive alternatives to global capitalism. This has been a real modus operandi of the American empire, and it's not going to change, even if it becomes a little more like low-key now. In my show last week, I stressed that there is far more continuity than change in American presidential politics. After all, I mean, the president is an emperor and the guardian of the global capitalist order, more so than anyone else on Earth. And those are the class forces that he defends and stands for and is prepared to use horrific violence to uphold and extend. Like, I understand the need for people to have hope. But hope, at least in my books, comes from winning victories against the institution, not the man. Presidents come and go, but the empire remains. The violence of empire remains. The racism of empire remains. And the plunder and exploitation of empire remains. Whether a particular president sucks particularly bad or not, the empire is the real threat, and it's a threat all over the world, not just in the states itself. And what the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917 did is it punched a big hole in the armor of the European-dominated global order at the time, paving the way for countless victories and the breakdown of a brutal colonial system all over the world. And working class and oppressed people will have to do something similar today if the present global order is to be defeated and overturned and something new, something better is going to be built in its place. You know, that armor needs to be punched through. And it's really through revolutionary action that that happens. So in conclusion, I want to congratulate Luis Arce, the new socialist president of Bolivia, who was just inaugurated on Sunday in defiance of right-wing threats and fascist street violence. He's the one who truly deserves praise right now, and not a certain Wall Street stooge who only got into power because he's not Trump, quote unquote. It's important to remember, to always remember, that the spirit of 1917 goes on. Anti-colonial struggles are still ongoing. People are still resisting capitalism and pushing for socialism as they fight for justice and a livable future. These people are the real heroes. And their victories are the real victories. So that's socialist victory, spearheaded by indigenous people in Bolivia, has far more meaning than what just happened in America. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Небо утреннего стяг, жизни важен первый шаг. Слышишь, веют над страною ветры яростных атак. И вновь продолжает собой, и сердцу тревожно в груди. И Ленин такой молодой, и юный октябрь впереди. И Ленин такой молодой, и юный октябрь впереди. Весь летит во все концы, вы поверьте нам, отцы. Будут новые победы, станут новые бойцы. И вновь продолжает собой, сердцу тревожно в груди. И Ленин такой молодой, и юный октябрь впереди. И Ленин такой молодой, и юный октябрь впереди.
С неба милости не жди, жизнь для правды не щади. Нам, ребята, в этой жизни только с правдой по пути.
И вновь продолжает собой, и сердцу тревожно в груди. И Ленин такой молодой, и юный октябрь впереди.
Listening to Back in the USSR, that was Lev Lutsenko, Soviet singer Lev Lutsenko, with the song Lenin is Young Again, a tribute to the enduring spirit of the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917 that continues all around the world to this day. So, what I want to transition into now on Back in the USSR is it's a talk by Michael Parenti, who, of course, I play quite a lot on this show, and you know, for good reason. I mean, he can explain a lot of these concepts, a lot of ideas, better than I can. And this particular talk, which he gives, is entitled Reality is Marxist. And I think it can explain better than I can the reason why 1917, why the Bolshevik Revolution is still relevant to this day, you know, very relevant, and why it should be understood. Because reality, fundamentally, is radical. And that is, you know, one of the reasons why the media is there, one of the reasons why the capitalist propaganda apparatus is there, is to blind us to that fact. When in reality, reality conforms to the radical understanding of history, of politics, of economics. And that's what this next talk is about. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
In 1907, this is what Woodrow Wilson said. 1907, this was, I don't even think he was yet governor of New Jersey. Well, he certainly wasn't president. Maybe he was governor. He was a political science professor and president of Princeton for a while, and then governor of New Jersey, and then president of the United States. In 1907, Woodrow Wilson noted the role that's played by the capitalist state on behalf of private capital. I quote him, "Since trade ignores national boundaries and the manufacturer insists on having the world as a market, the flag of his nation must follow him, and the doors of the nations which are closed against him must be battered down. Concessions obtained by financiers must be safeguarded by ministers of state." Now, you hear that? That's a bourgeois college professor, president of the United States. If I just read that statement, if I said the financiers are serviced by the ministers of state, the ministers of state have to safeguard the financiers. You know what people say? Oh, you're Marxist. That's Marxist, you know. I hear that. I used to hear that all the time. When I was just getting myself radicalized, I used to hear that. I'd say things like, I think racism is actually, you say it's a failure of capitalism. I think it's a success of capitalism because it's used to divide the working class. It's used to suppress wages. And my colleagues would say, that's Marx. That's Marx. I said, Marx? I thought that was Parenti. I look in the mirror. I'd say things like, I don't think the police are neutral. I think why in a strike they side with the factory owners and not the workers? Why are they there defending the property and not the right of the worker who has an entitlement in the labor that he invests? And I say, well, that's Marx. That's Marx. I would hear this all the time. I say, I don't think U.S. policy is so innocent. We're out there helping the finance. Oh, that's Marx, they'd say all the time. And I say, boy, this guy Marx was really something. Here I am. I'm knocking myself out trying to make an analysis. Every time I come up with something, they give him the credit. So, that's pretty good. And then I realize something. That wasn't Marx. That wasn't Parenti. That was reality. That's what it was. And reality happens to be Marxist. So let's repeat that sentence and go on. Woodrow Wilson is talking. Concessions obtained by financiers must be safeguarded by ministers of state, even if the sovereignty of unwilling nations be outraged in the process. Colonies must be obtained or planted in order that no useful corner of the world may be overlooked or left unused. Now, that does sound like Marx, the manifesto. The same wording, he says, capitalism goes into every corner of the world to recreate it in its own image and put it to use for its capital accumulation process. Interesting. Sometimes the flag will go in before the dollars get there, and that's to create new opportunities. For instance, in 1919, in Haiti, the people started a popular rebellion and revolution. They actually built a popular militia to try to get the land back from the landowners, to try to get the big companies out of there and all that. The U.S. declared political instability. They have certain code words, they use political instability, undemocratic forces, we got to defend it. Political instability, and of course, racism gets used very handily here. You say, these little brown people in this little island have to learn self-governance. See, we will have to go down and show them and at least bring law and order and stability back. So they went down just to take care of that. And they stayed a mere 19 years. And they killed 18,000 Haitians. And they also kicked out the French, German, and British companies, and U.S. companies came in. You see, capitalism not only fights the class war against its own laboring class, capital formations will often fight against each other and against other national capital formations. And, of course, the people pick up the tab on that, too. Yugoslavia is a great case in point. I have a book there called To Kill a Nation. Got any more copies of it? Good. See, here comes the infomercial now. We start. There it is. Okay. Yugoslavia was tolerated for quite some time as a breakaway country from the Eastern Bloc of Nations, so-called Bloc of Nations. But after 1990, the U.S. saw no reason to tolerate its existence anymore. I mean, here was a country, a rather large country right in Central Europe, which was not going the way of free market reforms as was happening in Russia, the Ukraine, Poland, and all over. They were not doing that usual thing. They were not, at first they weren't. Yugoslavia had an economy that was 80% state-owned still. Yugoslavia had a high standard of living and a high degree of economic equality. Anybody could go to school to the highest level they want, and medical care was free. Yugoslavia showed no interest in joining the European Union, no interest at all in joining NATO. It had a productive industrial base, a successful auto industry. 80% of the Yugoslav auto market was sold by the Yugo. It had construction firms that competed quite successfully and throughout, even in Western Europe. Now, when you destroy all that, you, of course, increase the value of your own capital. If I destroy your firms, I destroy your auto industry, I increase the value of my auto industry. If I destroy your agricultural base, I increase the value and open market opportunities for my agricultural base. And that's exactly what happened. German and U.S. agencies supported every retrograde secessionist and reactionary ethnic nationalist in Bosnia, in Croatia, and in Kosovo. And today, Yugoslavia has been broken up into a cluster of little right-wing republics where everything is privatized, everything's been deregulated, sold off to private investors at garage sale prices. That's the public capital of the people's labor is now given away to private investors, where the media have been taken over by rich private investors or conservatives. Pension funds have been plundered and disappeared. Public services have been shredded. I was just in Belgrade last March, and I was with a friend, and she said, well, I'm going to meet you later. It was a Saturday. Now, I'm going to meet you later, but I'm going to a doctor's appointment. I said, what do you mean? It's 7 o'clock Saturday night. You're going to see a doctor? Who sees a doctor at 7 o'clock? She says, oh, here in Yugoslavia, the doctors will see you anytime you want because they're so desperate for patients. The public health services are broken down, so people are literally without, unless you can pay, are literally without services. And 7 was a convenient time for her. And the doctor said, okay, sure. There's inflation in Yugoslavia now. There's unemployment, poverty, suicide, prostitution. All of this has skyrocketed, and we hear next to nothing about it in the press. It's a free market paradise. It has been brought into the fold of the West. That's Yugoslavia today. And unfortunately, there were too many people on the left who supported that war and swallowed the official line, they swallowed the mass media line right down their throats. They thought they were fighting rape, they thought they were fighting a demon called Milosevic, and they didn't, and they were just ill-informed and taken in. It's much too bad. And I'm including some very notable progressive speakers who swallowed that line, including one who calls himself a pacifist.
So read the Communist Manifesto. Guerrillas in the mix, the Guevara and Manesto. So
what a brother with an afro now.
Yo, go a flow for the Mac and we the hoes. So grow, cause the Lucian brothers might get hung. Rhetoric flowing from the tip of my mouth. Say tongue deficit.
Money spent.
Catch the glint.
On my 9 as they cut welfare 25%.
And I dissent as I clinch and raise my
we
fist.
We did away with that.
So you could get with this. It's a twist cause we'll overthrow like Kwame Nkrumah. Spread around the world as if it were a business rumor. Bam, cuts a record like a surgeon cuts a tumor from a brain.
We're all cooped up, so fill the tank.
From 400 years of exploitation, anesthesia provided by your local TV station. Patience is not a virtue.
I ain't waiting.
Turn this shit over like Bush did a boatload of hate. In a dog pound like H-Rap Brown with the situation.
Broke in no calluses,
cause we're spitting dialectical analysis. So how is this we never had no funk? Until you found out that our trunks are revolutionary, huh?
Chuck.
Bump you over like dominoes, rat.
So free Geronimo, you jack a prick.
Lyrics, hear it, lyric, can't get near it. Got a sample, didn't clear it. Point blank says, fuck 5-0, that's the spirit. Cheer it. Spat out the fact that I consumed, knew that I was doomed since my date of birth to be the wretched of the earth. Never had a dream that was American.
They go to like a Cherokee.
Disparagant.
But that ain't nothing new.
Told the streets where paper go, whoever paid that shit got minimum wage too. Dig it, dig it, dig it, dig it, dig it, dig it.
Do you understand?
this dungeon.
Exploited and they hung us. I'd like to take a moment to say fuck Columbus.
Millions off my back.
The black on black crisis is a myth. The crack that did the
What's
damage.
What's the one from the whip?
The record skip. The record skip. The record skip. The record skips cause my voice is kinda scratchy. From yelling don't you and 5-0 comes to harass me. They never pass me, no one to go and tell, bro.
Trying to kill the movement with the new COINTEL, bro.
Leaders they killed, if I said it, it was granted them. They only see my back because I'm 3 steps ahead of them. We're not falling in the slot, just slated.
We realize that our power is nickel plated.
Masses move as well as asses do. Classes through, our time is over, past us due.
And you still wanna know
the origin of the flow.
Oakland, California, now for 6-1 up. Yeah,
the coup
coming at you in
93. Yeah, and we out, y'all.
Do you understand the metaphoric phrase? Do you understand the metaphoric phrase? Do you understand the metaphoric phrase? Do you understand? Do you understand?
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, and that was The Coup, Boots Riley, singing Dig It, back from 1992, you know, one of the first, I think it was their first album, actually, of The Coup. And of course, before that, we had Michael Parenti with Reality Happens to be Marxist, which I think was really appropriate given the recent anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution, because reality does happen to be Marxist. And in fact, like, how I want to close out the show here, I think, is by playing a clip from a speech of Black Panther Party leader Fred Hampton, you know, heroic figure really in the black radical tradition in the U.S., and in, once again, unapologetic communist, a speech which he gave in the late 1960s, where he talks about how you can't kill the revolution. Once again, just as true, as much true today as it was then. Because you can't kill the revolution. I think that's the message we got to like give right here tonight on this show. Because that's what we got to take forward. You know, we're part of something here, brothers and sisters. We're part of something. And we got to keep building it. Keep fighting. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
We work with anybody and form coalition with anybody that has revolution on their mind. We're not a racist organization because we understand that racism is an excuse used for capitalism. And we know that racism is just, it's a byproduct of capitalism. Everything would be all right if everything was put back in the hands of the people. And we're going to have to put it back in the hands of the people. All power to the people. That's saying that no matter what color you are, there's only two classes. And that's saying there's a class over here and there's a class over there. And the reason that this class over here has never did anything to get this class off its back, because this is lower, this is upper. This is the oppressed, this is the oppressor. This is the exploited, this is the exploiter. And these people in this class have divided themselves. They say, I'm black and I hate white people. I'm white and I hate black people. I'm Latin American and I hate hillbillies. I'm hillbilly, I hate Indians. So we're fighting amongst each other. We know they have our pictures, we know they're looking for us, we know they want us, but we're still saying that even though we couldn't be in a sense, as far as this system goes, on the mountaintop, we in the Black Panther Party, because of our dedication and understanding what's in the valley, knowing that the people in the valley, knowing that we originally came from the valley, knowing that our flag is the same flag as the people in the valley, knowing that our enemy is on the mountaintop, our friends are in the valley, we say even though it's nice to be on the mountaintop, we're going back to the valley. I'd be in offices every day. I'd be in the streets propagandizing every day. I'd be working with everybody every day. I'd be teaching that solidarity is the thing. The end of a complete wipeout of imperialism is the thing. So if you're going to be thinking about me, that's what Bobby would be teaching. If you're going to be thinking about us, all we say is we don't, ain't no thing about going nowhere, getting killed. All we want to know is that you're doing what we'd be doing if we were here. And you've got to do that. You can't do it unless you believe that you can do it. Now, we say all power to all people.
All people.
We say white power to white people.
White power. Brown power to brown people.
Brown power.
Yellow power to yellow people.
Yellow.
Black power to black people.
Black power.
X power for those that we left out.
X power for those we left out.
We say Panther power to the Vanguard Party.
When you, brown power.
When you leave here, you know what I'm saying? The last words, before you go to bed tonight, say, I am a revolutionary. Make that the last word. In case you don't wake up, then somebody might believe it, and you might, you know, end up in what they call a revolutionary happy hunting grounds. Say that. Then I am a revolutionary.
Thing that people have to pay the price for peace. If you dare to struggle, you dare to win. If you dare not to struggle, then goddamn it, you don't deserve to win. Let me say peace to you if you're willing to fight for it. Let me say it in the spirit of liberation. I've been gone for a little while. At least my body's been gone. You ain't got to repeat after me. At least my body's been gone for a little while. But I'm back now, and I believe that I'm back to stay. I believe that I'm going to do my job, and I believe that I was born not to die in a car wreck. I don't believe I'm going to die in a car wreck. I don't believe I'm going to die from slipping on a piece of ice. I don't believe I'm gonna die because I got a bad heart. I don't believe I'm gonna die because of lung cancer. I believe that I'm going to be able to die what I was in the thing that I was born for. I believe that I'm going to be able to die high off the people. I believe that I will be able to die as a revolutionary in the International Revolutionary Proletarian Struggle. And I hope that each one of you will be able to die in the International Proletarian Revolutionary Struggle, even be able to live in it. And I think that struggle is going to come. Why don't you live for the people? Why don't you struggle for the people? Why don't you die for the people? When I leave, you're going to remember I said with the last words on my lips that I am a revolutionary. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
the bitch. The red, white, and blue spit on you.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's all the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system works. Jerk, my people, the people all around the pig work. Tell me I'm wrong, though. That's my writing is writing the Constitution. Yo, that shit's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too.
the motherfucking slave ship. Let's find the people who hate this shit. These are the places we'll hit.
Panama, talking about Peru. Azania, Brixton, Belfast, and forget Korea. Beirut, and forget Haiti. Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talking about Uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy, never ran, never will, Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
When I feel alone, I sing. Happy birthday to me. Today is my birthday. No, not today is the day of my birth, but today is the day of my rebirth, because every day that I do this poem, I reemerge from within this womb of myself, and I'm alone. The same way I'm going to die. Alone, but hopefully not lonely. See, I want the few who do and will know me to know that life knew how to hold me and that I died in her arms right where I belonged. Embracing, discovering every fold of skin one can get lost in, the cost is I will have to do it alone. The same way we all dream. And really, would it be any clearer if I said God wrote a letter saying truth is, Deanna, I gotta go, because there's over 7 billion people that need directions or a miracle, and that's only on this earth. And what about the universe and the unimaginable amount of animals you could imagine don't believe in me? And there's a million more forests that need more rings, because life is getting engaged to trees. And there's 200,000 more leagues into the sea that I got to keep a secret, because honestly, I see you all as destructive creatures. And there's plants I got to protect so this world will have what it needs to heal it. I am not forsaking you. No, I am not your father whose heart will be in heaven. Hallowed be thy silent shame. I'm just leaving you my spirit and free will, understanding there'll be days you curse my name. So you take care while I'm gone. Find my voice and yours to keep you strong, and I'll leave your life with teachers who will inspire you and remind you of what I can do, and that words are more than a sound or sounds forming meaningful elements of speech. They are powerful tools to reach those like you who are of this state of solitude, a place where when you blink, it's just you behind the eyelids. If I said this, would that help you to get this message that life is a revolving door system? You're born alone. You struggle to connect because this life hurts. It hurts like being considered 3/5 of a human being. Tattooed identification, deaf ears, and assassinations. Like bloody broom handles. Like empty yet distended stomachs. Like emptied, then reloaded, then reloaded, then reloaded clips. Like unsolicited long journeys and goodbyes, like concrete beds and cardboard sheets, like ghettos, like glue in paper bag track marks, stray bullets and landmines, the Willie Lynch plan, like being orphaned, like women and children being raped, like land being auctioned, having to sell yourself, like closets and hate. This life hurts like a broken heart. And then you die alone. Sound about right? Who here hasn't caught themselves asking, God, what's your problem? Why are we faced with such plights? But there is no reply, because he knows that we know that if we are to keep this communication through the darkness, it's gonna come through continuous communication and unity equaling community. Mesh fingers, rallies, and sincere apologies. Through head bobs, hugs, and how was your days? Through I love yous. Sun settings and smiles. Through hope. And the end will justify the means. If you, if I can echo, you are not alone. Alone. To your reflection and mean it. Don't you agree? Don't you want to be a part of something, fit in somewhere not inside the box or on the fence, but somewhere in between? If so, when you feel alone, sing. Happy birthday to me. With me. Because to die alone could be done with ease, but to live together requires work. Work that cannot be done alone.